This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Secretary of State is in Iraq for talks on the Islamic State group. A warning that Libya could become a terrorist hub.
If they don't take over, at least they have a playground and a training area where they will definitely have opportunities.
American Ukrainians remain tense, fearful, and angry about developments in their nation. Remembering back 20 years after the Cairo Population Summit, and the Apple Electronics Company rolls out its latest electronic gadgets. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he is encouraged by the new Iraqi Prime Minister's commitment to fighting the Islamic State extremist group. Kerry made the comments in the Iraqi capital Baghdad at the start of a week-long trip in the region. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from the Iraqi capital.
Secretary Kerry is here to meet with new Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who a senior State Department official says has very clear objectives and a very different outlook than his predecessor Nouri al-Maliki, whose marginalization of Iraq's Sunni minority played a part in the rise of Islamic State militants. Before leaving Washington, Kerry said this new government has the potential to unite all of Iraq's diverse communities and should now rule with the same vision and sense of purpose that brought it together.
And in that effort, they should know the United States will stand shoulder to shoulder with the Iraqis as they implement their national plan to overcome the long-standing political and economic grievances that have for too long divided their country.
A senior State Department official said Prime Minister al-Abadi plans to devolve security responsibilities, giving provincial leaders principal authority over local security through locally recruited salaried guardsmen. That's meant to reassure not only Iraqi Sunni, but also the semi-autonomous Kurds. The senior State Department official said Mr. al-Abadi is not going to take military units from the south and go into areas in the north and west to take on the militants, also known as ISIL. The people of Anbar will take on ISIL, as they're doing now in Haditha, the official said, adding the people of Nineveh will take on ISIL in Nineveh, and they'll have assistance from the National Army when they need it. Baghdad is the first stop on a week-long trip during which Kerry says he's working to build the broadest coalition possible against the Islamic State. He says some in that coalition will help train, arm, and equip Iraqi forces. Others will contribute humanitarian relief or help cut off militant funding or block the flow of foreign fighters. President Barack Obama plans to address the American people Wednesday evening on his strategy to deal with the Islamic State threat. While that will clearly involve a large number of Arab leaders with whom Kerry will meet in Saudi Arabia, the principal front is here in Iraq, where a senior State Department official says there's a chance now. If we were talking 2 months ago on a lot of these issues, it would be hard to see a way forward. The new prime minister's cabinet is still without ministers of defense and interior. The senior State Department official said Mr. al-Abadi was extremely close to getting consensus on those posts, and he thought it a wise move to have delayed them. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Baghdad.
World leaders are expected to watch President Obama's address today to see how he has developed a strategy to fight the Islamic State militants, with particular interest in whether he will be able to bring Middle Eastern countries into the coalition announced at the NATO summit last week. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
The United States has launched more than 100 airstrikes against the militants in Iraq, supporting local forces and protecting key installations. At the NATO summit last week, nearly a dozen countries agreed to work together on intelligence, logistics, and other aspects of the fight. Now, President Obama is launching a broader strategy and inviting more countries to join, something he signaled at the end of the summit.
And I think it is absolutely critical that we have Arab states, and specifically Sunni majority states, that are rejecting the kind of extremist nihilism that we're seeing out of ISIL, that say that is not what Islam is about, and are prepared to join us actively in the fight.
Experts say the participation of Middle Eastern countries is crucial to defeat the militant fighters, who are known as ISIL, ISIS, and by their new name, the Islamic State. They've taken over wide areas of Iraq and Syria and killed or terrorized thousands of local residents. Yet research consultant Kathleen McInnes of London's Chatham House cautions that coalitions are much more easily built than maintained.
While everybody agrees that ISIS is odious, they need to be defeated, the regional players, you know, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, they all have very different interests and objectives for the region.
And Mr. Obama will have to work hard even to convince U.S. allies to do more in the fight against Islamic State, according to James Boyes of London's King's College, who spoke via Skype.
The world is very much waiting, I think, for this White House to take the lead. One of the challenges, I think, is it's very, very difficult for European powers, I think, to take seriously a president and an administration who only a week or so ago was basically saying there is no strategy with regard to what's going on.
Still, Britain has already announced it will sell weapons to the Iraqi military, and experts say the formation of a new Iraqi government could make it possible to get more Iraqis to join the fight against the militants. President Obama's goal is not necessarily to build as large a coalition as the U.S. had in Afghanistan, nearly 60 countries which paid tribute to their veterans and fallen troops at a NATO summit ceremony. But the experts say it must be broad and capable enough to defeat an enemy similar to Afghanistan's Taliban, a militant group that controls a wide area. And that's why Kathleen McInnes says the president's speech on Wednesday is so important.
It's going to be an incredibly important speech because he needs to make the case that not only is the time now for the international community to act, but also that he is serious, that the Obama administration, the United States of America, is willing to do what it takes to eliminate the ISIS threat.
In recent decades, the United States has led coalitions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Soon, the world will hear President Obama's ideas for a new coalition to fight a new threat in that same part of the world. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
President Obama says he has a strategy for defeating Islamic State militants in the Middle East. And as we mentioned, here in Washington Wednesday night, he says he will explain the nature of the threat and how he plans to deal with it. Mr. Obama's address to the nation will reportedly lay out his hopes for an international coalition to support Iraqi and Kurdish ground troops in fighting the militants. VOA's coverage of the president's remarks will be heard here on the radio on VOA TV affiliates and streamed live at voanews.com. Our coverage begins at 8:30 p.m. Washington time Wednesday night. That's Thursday at 0:30 Universal Time.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian sounded an alarm over Libya Tuesday, calling on the international community to mobilize, warning the North African country could become a terrorist hub. In an interview with the French publication Le Figaro, the French defense chief said, southern Libya is a place where terrorist groups go to resupply and reorganize. He said the country's economic and political centers are now at risk of falling under jihadist control. Libya is said is a gateway both to Europe and the Sahara. Media reports portray the country as a failed state, like Somalia, 3 years after the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Reuters says Islamist militants of Ansar al-Sharia, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization, are threatening to take control of the country's second-largest city, Benghazi. The Associated Press reports the Islamist-allied militia takeover of the capital, Tripoli, last month and creation of a rival government is raising alarm in the West. UK-based The Guardian says the newly elected Libyan parliament is reduced to residing aboard a Greek car ferry in the eastern port of Tobruk. VOA quotes a senior advisor to Mohamed Jibril, who served as de facto prime minister following the ouster of Gaddafi, as saying Islamic fighters have started to arrive in Libya, warning the country could become a safe haven for jihadists. Ian Lussick, a political science professor at the University of Pennsylvania and Middle East analyst, told VOA's Victor Beatty that it was Gaddafi himself who warned the country would explode without a strongman at the top.
He was right because he had a very easy time taking power. He pushed aside a kingdom that had not had to do any state building in Libya. It had oil and it had American support. So it never had to organize the country. And the country really needed organizing because the Italians pulverized it when they ruled it. So there was no colonial state to work with, and there was no King Idris to work with. So Gaddafi took it over and built his own idiosyncratic kind of patrimonial system, all linked to him. So when he was pushed aside, there had never been any preparation for a real state of Libya. That's fundamentally the problem. Plunges the country back toward real anarchy, where the clans and tribes, animated even more vigorously by the prospect of acquiring huge amounts of wealth because of Libya's oil, go at each other's throats. What's really frustrating is that in this context, traditionally in the Middle East, it has been Islam that offers a way to unify disparate kinship and tribal groups under a single identity. And we do have in Libya Islamist groups fighting to do that. But from the point of view of Egypt, it has just had an anti-Islamist counter-revolution, and the conservative Gulf states, such as the United Arab Emirates, that's intolerable. Nor does the West really want to see an Islamist state. So in a way, the one option open to Libya is being closed by those outside it.
Do you expect Egypt or other regional powers or the United States or NATO to get involved?
No, I don't, because there's no path organized forward that any one of those would find attractive. I fear that they will try to prevent what they don't want to happen in Libya. From the point of view of the Egyptians, that the Islamists taking control. But other than that, I don't see a force willing to take the risks of entering Libya and organizing it. Of course, what this does is open the prospect of a Syrian-like struggle in a much more, a smaller country in terms of population. But it also opens the prospect of another field of operation for al-Qaeda and ISIS-type extremists, if they don't take over, at least to have a playground and a training area where they will definitely have opportunities to attack targets and perhaps take hostages again.
Lustig says after attempts in Iraq and Afghanistan at nation building, the West had no interest in intervening in Libya following the ouster of Gaddafi, and it's paying the cost of what he calls its benign neglect. Karim Mizran, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Atlantic Council, told VOA the international community must step in and threaten military intervention, forcing all warring factions to leave major urban areas and surrender their weapons. That, he says, could be followed by an international peacekeeping force and national reconciliation talks. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says he will submit a bill to Parliament next week granting parts of the separatists East greater autonomy, but keeping them part of Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko announced the move at a cabinet meeting today. He promised special status to some areas of the rebel-controlled regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, but he rejected any talk of federalization or total independence. Pro-Russian separatists have been battling government troops in eastern Ukraine in recent months. A ceasefire between government troops and pro-Russian separatists has brought a temporary lull in the crisis gripping that nation, but many of the estimated 1.2 million Americans of Ukrainian descent remain tense, fearful, and angry. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with some of them in New York.
Most of these teenagers singing the Ukrainian national anthem at St. George's Academy in New York City were either born in Ukraine or their parents were. Their school principal, the Reverend Peter Shishka, is himself the son of Ukrainian immigrants. He encourages the students' patriotic pride, adding that it may be necessary for Ukraine to go to war rather than lose its independence, which it won in 1991 after the breakup of the Soviet Union.
What is the alternative? Do we want the same domination that we've had for centuries with Russia, where they think that this is their empire? We've had enough of that. It's also a matter of prayer, of meditating. Where do we stand? What is our reaction to all of this? Are we compassionate people? Are we supportive of those that are suffering or undergoing persecution? We just can't be screaming with placards. Anger isn't going to do it. Hate isn't going to do it.
Shishka's students also have seemingly contradictory viewpoints. Some, like Xenia Vitovich, have family friends who recently returned to Ukraine from New York to fight the pro-Russian separatists.
Honestly, like, the people that go there to fight are just literally volunteering to give up their life for the sake of their country. I mean, they're fighting for their independence and their homeland, and they're fighting against people who know how to fight.
Others are organizing bake sales or working for Ukrainian diaspora organizations to raise money to purchase emergency first aid kits for the army. Alexandra Azer, whose father is Egyptian and whose mother is Polish, is trying to offer her Ukrainian-American classmates emotional support.
You hear how sad they are. Like, we just try to tell them, like, everything's going to be okay. Like, we try to listen and make sure, like, we are updated also with the news and not, like, we're clueless to what's going on.
Alexandra Rokowski was a small child when she came to this country just after World War II. A fluent Ukrainian speaker, she remains deeply attached to her homeland.
So when something is happening on a scale that's happening in Ukraine now, we tend to be very worried and tend to write letters to our congressmen and senators and try to help financially through different channels.
The Ukrainian Congress Committee of America represents the million or so Americans of Ukrainian descent. It's organizing demonstrations and lobbying the U.S. government to act more forcefully. Spokesman Andrei Dobryansky says the U.S. and its European allies should start by designating Ukraine a major non-NATO ally.
And that would immediately cut down on the red tape of transfers of military supplies back and forth. Other things is sending those supplies, anti-tank munitions, anti-aircraft munitions, any kind of equipment that can help Ukraine secure its border.
Dobryansky's group believes Vladimir Putin's Russia is waging a war to erase his country. Still, he remains optimistic. A quarter century ago, many doubted Ukraine would ever become independent. We were supposed to have been wiped off the map for good hundreds of years ago, he says. Yet here we are. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
It's been 20 years since the International Conference on Population and Development was held in Cairo. Many consider the landmark meeting's greatest achievement to be the recognition of women's rights and empowerment. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UN Population Fund says the September 1994 conference linked population and development and focused on meeting the needs of individual women and men. The key to this new approach, it says, was empowering women and providing them with more choices through expanded access to education and health services, skill development, and employment. Secretary of State John Kerry, then a U.S. senator, was a delegate to the Cairo summit.
You know, I remember leading that delegation to Cairo back when there really was a conspiracy of silence on family planning, sexual and reproductive health, and reproductive rights. And a lot of folks back then were very frightened. They were still afraid to talk about the connections between women's empowerment and women's rights and development, let alone to think that we could actually turn the tide.
He says since 1994, the commitments made by nearly 180 governments shows that the tide is turning.
But it's not a done deal, and we all know that. There are places pushing back. There's a tide of resistance to modernity, and we see it playing out not just in the context of women's rights, but we see it playing out in every single respect with respect to opportunity and dignity and the ability of people to be able to share fully in the choices about their lives.
Nevertheless, Kerry says more lives are being saved and more opportunities are being provided than ever before. Speaking at the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Secretary of State warns no country can progress if it ignores half its population.
From Kabul to Kinshasa to Kuala Lumpur, I have seen with my own eyes the extraordinary difference that it makes when women and girls can decide if and when to have children. When they're empowered, educated, and equipped to be able to contribute to a strong and a stable and a prosperous society.
He says the nations must adopt a zero-tolerance policy on discrimination, violence, and human rights abuses against women and men.
That violence has no place in the 21st century, period. And we're going to continue to do everything in our power to stop it.
Secretary Kerry adds that HIV/AIDS prevention must be part of any approach to development, and that family planning be fully integrated into those prevention efforts. He adds more must be done to provide economic opportunities to what he calls a staggering youth population. In many countries, most of the population is now under age 30. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Apple electronics company rolled out its new iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus in an elaborate ceremony in Cupertino, California, Tuesday.
Today, we are launching the biggest advancement in the history of iPhone.
Apple CEO Tim Cook told the crowd the iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus will feature larger displays and extra-tough screens made from scratch-resistant material.
These are the new iPhones, the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus. They are, without a doubt, the best iPhones we've ever done. And I hope you'll agree, they're the best phones you have ever seen.
Apple Senior Vice President of Marketing, Phil Schiller, said that the phones do offer larger screens than previous models.
And yes, they're bigger. They're a lot bigger. Here on the left is an iPhone 5S. In the center, iPhone 6. And on the right, the iPhone 6 Plus. I think you can see the difference. And if you don't know, here's their sizes. 4.7 inch for iPhone 6. 5.5 inches for iPhone 6 Plus.
Apple's larger phones will move it into a direction with competition with rival Samsung, which is launching its Padlet Note 4 last week. Also Tuesday, the California company rolled out its new Apple Watch, its first new market product in several years. Cook said the watch was built with users in mind.
We set out to make the best watch in the world, one that is precise. It's synchronized with the universal time standard, and it's accurate within plus or minus 50 milliseconds. It's incredibly customizable, so you can find one that reflects your personal style and taste.
The watch combines health and fitness tracking with communications and applications. The watch is scheduled to go on sale in 2015. Prices for the watch will start at $349. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History.
On September 10th, 1509, an earthquake known at the time as the Lesser Judgment Day hit Constantinople. The quake struck an area in the Sea of Marmara in the northeast of Turkey. It is believed that more than 10,000 people were killed. In 1608, Captain John Smith was elected council president of Jamestown, Virginia. Jamestown was the first permanent English settlement in the Americas. On this date in 1813, Oliver H. Perry sent his famous message, "We have met the enemy and they are ours," after defeating the British in the Battle of Lake Erie in the War of 1812. In 1846, Elias Howe was granted a patent for the sewing machine. On this day in 1960, Ethiopian runner Abebe Bikila became the first sub-Saharan African to win an Olympic gold medal. Unable to find shoes that fit properly, Bikila ran his marathon barefoot, saying he wanted the whole world to know that his country has always won with determination and heroism. On this day in 1963, a group of black students entered public schools in Alabama, ending the era of racially segregated schools in the state. Despite a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court ending segregation, Alabama's Democratic Governor George Wallace vowed to close schools that planned to integrate. President Kennedy ordered federal assistance to achieve integration, and a group of black students were enrolled. In 2007, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif returned to his country after 7 years in exile. He has been elected Prime Minister three times, representing the Pakistan Muslim League. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Building on a long legacy of support for the aspirations of the Burmese people, the United States is providing assistance to deepen and accelerate Burma's political, economic, and social transition, promote and strengthen respect for human rights, deliver the benefits of reform to the country's people, and support the development of a stable society that reflects the diversity of all its people. Increased U.S. assistance to Burma reflects the U.S. government's support for Burma's political and economic transition. Since 2012, the United States has provided over $200 million in assistance to Burma. U.S. assistance is targeted to five key goals: national reconciliation, democratic institutions, healthy communities, economic development, and regional cooperation. Sustaining national unity through peaceful political rather than military means is essential to the long-term success of reform. By creating opportunities for greater participation, trust-building, and tolerance, U.S. assistance seeks to build networks of cooperation and understanding among Burma's diverse citizenry, strengthen processes for peace and national reconciliation, and combat hate speech. U.S. assistance builds the capacity of democratic institutions and a politically engaged civil society, promotes human rights, and strengthens rule of law. In 2013, the United States provided technical and capacity support for more than 300 civil society organizations and 5,800 individuals to engage in Burma's transition and political processes. U.S. assistance improves the lives of millions across Burma. This includes programs aimed at reducing under-5 child mortality and transmission of high-burden infectious diseases and improving water supplies for thousands of Burmese communities. U.S. assistance also funds efforts to help internally displaced persons and support people at risk of contracting HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis, overcome malnutrition, and aid communities still affected by landmines. The United States believes that responsible investment will promote economic reform and inclusive economic development to improve the welfare of the Burmese people. Partnering with the private sector, other governments, donors, and civil society, U.S. assistance aims to significantly reduce poverty in targeted areas over the next 5 years. As chair of the 10-Nation Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, in 2014, Burma plays an important role in promoting regional peace and stability, as well as economic and social development. The United States is accelerating Burma's development and ASEAN connectivity through a number of programs in cooperation with private sector partners. The United States is proud to work with Burma in realizing the full potential of Burma's remarkable people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.